when we take on leadership, you're taking on leading all people. And it doesn't matter male, female, white, black. It's your responsibility to communicate with people and make them feel included. You sleep less, there is a link between less sleep and cancer. Knowing that we have additional stressors, that means we have to take on the responsibility of making ourselves more resilient. If you truly show people that you care about them and you're there for them, you have a much greater chance of helping people through really difficult times. When people get through to the other side, a lot of times they're happy to share their story because they know that it can help others. The more trauma they're exposed to, the greater opportunities people have for growth.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my guest co-host, Captain Ram Duckworth. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Battalion Chief Dina Ali of the Raleigh Fire Department, and we'll be talking about the impact of organizational leadership on mental wellness and a whole lot more. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, bbsradio.com, all the podcast platforms, and check out our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Chief Ali after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job.
In this family, up to a quarter of 911 telecommunicators have symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis,
while responders are quietly suffering.
In this family, many struggle with job-related stress,
burnout, trauma, sleep disruptions, substance abuse,
and relationship problems.
In this family, we can help the helpers.
With vital information and resources,
resilience strategies,
and success stories of overcoming the obstacles.
In this family, no one is alone.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rimley, LCSW, EMTB.
And I'd like to welcome my special guest co-host, Captain Ram Duckworth, who I've had the honor of working with in several different capacities. Just a little background on Ram. He's currently a career fire captain and paramedic EMS coordinator with the Ridgefield, Connecticut Fire Department. He's also the founder and author of chapters in more than a dozen EMS, fire, rescue, and medical textbooks, as well as over 100 published articles in fire and EMS journals, magazines, and websites. So welcome, Ram.
Thank you, Dave.
And our special guest today is Battalion Chief Dina Ali of the Raleigh, North Carolina Fire Department with 15 years of service. She has a master's in public administration from the University of North Carolina in Pembroke. Chief, welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Hey, thank you guys. Excited to be here.
So, Ram, you want to jump in with the first one?
Yeah. Absolutely. Chief, we typically like to start with some perspective on how you got where you are today. I guess starting with what drew you to the profession? What made you choose emergency services?
Well, growing up, I was always that quintessential tomboy. I love sports. I love playing outside, being on my bicycle. I was, you hear sirens and you get excited. So then I watched all the shows, Cops, Third Watch, all that stuff. And I always wanted to be a police officer. That was the goal. And I did that, but it didn't take long to realize I'd made a horrible mistake. And fortunately, a few years into it, the television show Rescue Me came on. And on season two, they had a female firefighter. And I don't know why, but up until then, I didn't realize that women I knew they could be firefighters. I didn't know that women should be firefighters. I thought it was a male-dominated profession and that we shouldn't insert ourselves into that, with a 24-hour lifestyle. But then after watching Rescue Me, I realized, I was like, wait a minute, women can do this. So I made the switch and I have never looked back.
That's fantastic. And it's amazing the impact that these TV shows have on us and probably, hundreds, if not thousands of other people who have made career choices based on, watching Emergency or watching whatever show it is that they gravitate to. So powerful.
No, absolutely. And I know like us as first responders, we watch these shows now and we criticize them and we put them down and we are very critical. But I think a lot of us, like you just said, we forget that could be the only way that others out there realize that this is a profession that's inclusive or, the other pieces of it. So they're definitely important. And I know we're completely going off on a tangent already.
All good.
I had the pleasure of meeting one of the writers for Chicago Fire. He's retired with 36 years with the Chicago Fire Fire Department. Mm-hmm. And I've got to tour the set. And they focus so much on trying to present our career in a positive light and showing the diversity. And if you pay attention, you'll see like Miranda Mayo, who plays Lieutenant Kidd, is like who they've kind of put in the spotlight. And I just think it's really cool. I remember they said early on, the network wanted the sex, the drugs, the stuff that makes more people watch the show. But they put their foot down after season one and they said, we're not going to do this. Like, we don't want to portray our like the career field in this light. So I thought that was pretty cool.
For sure. And offline, we were just having a conversation about other TV shows that kind of give us, I don't know, great role models of leaders. And in a way you could study them. And we were talking about Ted Lasso and Bear and even Friday Night Lights. And speaking of that modeling of leadership, so we all have this moment when we're kind of making the decision to promote and move up. And maybe we have that, I don't know, moment of crisis where we may not feel like we were worthy or deserving or, you know, not have the confidence. So in your journey, Chief, was there a moment like that? Did you have any time when you had to kind of overcome, you know, lack of confidence and security in making that promotional move?
Oh, man, every single promotion, every single promotion. And I think especially like for me, two reasons. Number one, I promoted kind of quickly, so I never thought that I had the appropriate amount of experience. And then just the extra challenge of being a female. And I don't like to say, oh, poor me, but it is an extra challenge, especially when you work with people who didn't realize they'd be working with women. And I know within my department and even the profession, women leadership roles are a newer thing. So mm-hmm. that extra challenge of promoting to those roles and being able to like communicate with the men and show respect and also finding your own way, because you can try to model yourself after some of your leaders. But what I realized is some of the ways that I was led, I can't lead people in that same way because it'll turn them off. So just trying to find my own path. But no, every single rank definitely, you know, questioned, am I ready? But especially the battalion chief. I did promote to battalion chief quickly compared to others in my department. And to me, I felt that to be a good battalion chief, I was supposed to be perfect in the role of captain and know every answer to everything. And I didn't. I definitely worked hard though. And I trained and I read and I went to conferences and I was very engaged. And it took talking to a mentor and talking to actually my current battalion chief at the time to have him kind of push me into it and, you know, let me know, hey, you are ready. Don't hold yourself back. And so I'm grateful I took the leap because I still screw up every day and make mistakes. But the biggest thing I learned is if you stay engaged and if you care about people and you care about doing a good job, you're probably a lot more ready than you'll ever think you are.
Mm-hmm. Chief, you were talking before about the mentors who are a mentor who'd helped you and some of the struggles of being a female in emergency services. And one of the programs I'm involved in is the NAMT's Lighthouse Leadership Program. And I was lucky enough to interview a young lady who wanted to step up in her role. And she expressed to us how important it was specifically to have a female mentor, if possible, because she wanted to have that modeling and be with somebody who understood some of the struggles that no matter how good a male leader just wasn't going to understand. And she was afraid she wasn't going to be able to connect. And those were the kind of problems she was really trying to strike out for. So I wanted to ask if you have found that as a leader in your position that you've had the opportunity or seen the need for mentorship of other females as well as, you know, helping bring them along and help them realize their potential.
Oh, no, absolutely. Because there are additional challenges. And like I mentioned earlier, even when you step into the leadership role, making sure that you communicate with people and are able to connect with people. And there are challenges that come with that. So absolutely having female mentors is important. And then for me, it has kind of been neat to be able to talk to some of the younger female firefighters and give them a different perspective And, you know, a lot of them, what I found is a lot of females will kind of hold themselves back a little bit because they want to be perfect in every role before they promote. And you'll never be perfect in any role. And you'll see a female that's doing really well, who is good at what she does, is engaged. And right beside her, a male who is just kind of, you know, going through the motions, and he feels ready and he's taking the promotional test, whereas she's like, no, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. And so it's neat to be able to give them the confidence, let them know, no, you are ready. You're so much more ready than a lot of people. You're doing a good job. But I do want to caution that with sometimes, and I've seen this happen, people automatically assume that the only person that can mentor a female is another female. Mm-hmm. And even male officers will say, oh, I can't even talk to her. I need to find somebody else. And that's so dangerous. When we take on leadership, you're taking on leading all people. And it doesn't matter male, female, white, black, religion. Like, it's your responsibility to communicate with people and make them feel included. And females need male mentors just as much as they need female mentors. And I wanted to just kind of throw that out there because I've seen here and there where there's almost a dismiss of the male mentor at times, and that shouldn't happen.
Our greatest asset is a thinking, knowledgeable, well-trained, physically fit, and healthy firefighter. It is the continual drive to be better, to improve, and to never be satisfied with the status quo. Success begins long before the alarm comes in or the tones go off. Success is nothing new in the FDNY. We did not suddenly wake up one day and become good at what we do. We need enthusiastic leadership and training that has a clear understanding of what's at stake. That is teamwork. That is dedication. That is well-trained firefighters ready to go to work on game day. The time to train is now, before the incident or game day.
We've all seen the leader who's tactically proficient but lacks the people skills for true inspirational leadership. Cornerstones of Leadership, on and off the fire ground, discusses the soft skills necessary for success, both on and off the fire ground.
I just want to take that another step further because, you know, we're all human beings, no matter what our rank is, and whether we're a captain, a chief, company officers are real people, and we have our own ups and downs, our own personal lives. And the end of the day, you know, we're all, you know, we're all on a journey. So given that we all have this life outside of the fire service or outside of being first responders, what are your thoughts about being resilient and being our best as leaders with all that's going on outside of work?
Now, I think, there's so much to unpack right there, by the way. Like, I'm already in my head. I'm like, wait, which direction do I go with this? There is a lot, but no, I appreciate the question because even, you know, the intro video where we talk about the additional stressors for first responders and, you know, higher rates of certain conditions and even, you know, suicide. And so with that, knowing that we have additional stressors, that means we have to protect ourselves a little better. We have to take on the responsibility of making ourselves more resilient because we're never going to be able to not run calls. And there's always going to be a crew or a shift that's overnight. And these things we know are detrimental to our physical and mental health. But what's cool and what's beautiful and what we know from all of the research is the more stress a person endures, the more adversity they endure, the more trauma they're exposed to, the greater opportunities people have for growth. Mm-hmm. And if you don't experience any of those stressors and adversities, you won't have the opportunity to be as strong as, you know, the person who has. And I think sometimes we forget that because I hear it and I see it where first responders are like, man, after 20 years, 25 years, I'm broken. I'm destroyed. This career has taken everything from me. And that's absolutely going to happen if we don't take care of ourselves. But if we understand that we're going to be exposed to stressors and that we can be resilient by taking care of ourselves, that we'll be stronger, then we won't be those people, hopefully. Right. Resilience is kind of where my focus of research and work is, and not just resilience in the sense of bounce back. I actually, don't be mad at me because of the title of the podcast, but I hate the word resilience. And the reason I hate it is because of the misuse of the word resilience. Mm-hmm. Time and time again, people say, resilience is bouncing back or recovering your shape. And what we know is resilience is much more than that, or the way we use it, it's much more than that. It's becoming something new. It's growth after. And have you read Nassim Taleb's book, Anti-Fragile?
Not yet, no.
No. So a friend of mine actually suggested it. It's a very deep and difficult read, but it's a really neat concept. So he explains that we need a new word for resilience and growth after trauma. And right now the word he uses is anti-fragile, but he even admits that that word is not the best word. And he spends like a whole chapter talking about language. But now that I've completely gone in a whole nother direction that we didn't need to go in, I'll come back to what you're asking. So yes, we're going to be exposed to stressors. We're going to be exposed to trauma. And if we're not protected, if we're not well taken care of, it could hurt us. But if we understand components that will make us stronger, we have the opportunity to, you know, move through all of these micro traumas and all of these events. Well, as I said, he would make an appearance at some point.
There he is. Yeah.
Right. Every podcast, he will find a way to sit on the chair behind me.
All right. You'll have to send me his social media link so we can include him.
I should probably do that. So some of the things that I've learned, you know, for example, early in my career, like most of my career, I never truly understood the value of sleep and how important sleep was. And so like so many other people, we all want to be busy. We want to be productive. We want to do as much as we can for as many people as we can. And when we do that, we cut out, like the first thing we cut out is sleep. And most first responders, when I travel or teach or speak and you do a survey, you know, how many people in this room sleep more than 6 hours a night? There might be three or four hands. You know, how many people average more than 5 hours? Just a few more hands come up. We're not getting the appropriate amount of sleep. And it was really fascinating to learn all that sleep does for mental wellness. And I had the really awesome opportunity of interviewing Dr. Matthew Walker,
who wrote
the book. Yeah, it was awesome. He came to a conference in Las Vegas and we got to sit down and I got to ask him questions related to the first responder world.
Cool.
Yeah. Oh man, it was amazing. I recorded it. So, which is awesome. But one of the analogies he used when we talked about trauma was he explained the role that sleep plays in removing the emotional response from a traumatic memory. And the analogy he used was like the bitter rind of an orange. And basically, you know, that bitter rind is kind of like the equivalent of the emotion, whereas the orange, the sweet inside, is the memory, which isn't so harmful. And when you sleep and you're in REM sleep, basically what REM sleep is doing is removing that bitter rind, and it's removing the emotional response from the memory. So you wake up and you have the memory, but not the emotion, or the emotional response to that memory. but what's so important that a lot of us don't understand is that REM sleep dominates the last 2 hours of sleep. Almost 75% of REM sleep happens between hours 6 and 8. So if you, on average, sleep 6 hours, you're not getting the REM sleep you need, and you're going to be more likely to have PTSD because you're not going to be able to strip away the emotional response to those memories. And it was just really cool understanding how REM sleep lets you integrate the memory without that emotion. And that way, the next day, you're able to go forward with that memory, but not be so disturbed by it. But then so many other things in terms of resilience that I think we don't realize are so important. So, for example, there's new research out now on play. And I love it because my whole adult life and this career has taught me like less play, more work, right? We have to be productive. If, you know, in the morning at shift change, the question is always like, hey, what are you doing today? What do you got going on? And if you're not saying I'm going to work, you feel lazy. But it was so fascinating to learn that there's research on play and the value of play, that in fact, play is like a form of mindfulness, and it's an amazing way to recover from stressors. And in fact, I hope I say this right, but the question was, you know, what's the opposite of play? And, you know, everybody wants to say work, but the opposite of play is depression, anxiety. And the research has found that if you live a life void of play, you're going to be more likely to suffer from anxiety and depression. And in fact, they connected a lot of the, you know, school shooters and mass murderers. They found a lack of play in their early lives. And that's kind of what may have led to whatever condition caused them to, you know, act out the way they did. Yeah. Because in early life, play helps you learn empathy and connection with others. But in adult life, that empathy and connection with others without worrying, without a focus, without keeping track on time is what helps you recover from the stressors of the day. And play is really strongly related to heart rate variability and the polyvagal theory. Are y'all, have y'all kind of dove down in that direction?
Awesome. Yes. Uh-huh.
So yeah, that's so heart rate variability is something that I'm looking at a lot more now. Because what we know is it is the only biomarker that can measure resilience. You know, the researchers on PTSD found that people with higher heart rate variability are less likely to end up with PTSD, and people with lower heart rate variability are more likely. So then how do you get higher and lower? And what they found was the more time you're in your sympathetic nervous system, the more time fight or flight is engaged, the lower your heart rate variability will be. Whereas the more time that you rest and recover, the higher your heart rate variability will be and the more resilient you are. So how do you increase heart rate variability? Play is a big one. Play is a huge one, along with sleep. And then we know the power of oxytocin from relationships. So relationships. But what I thought was really cool was for years, you know, people are telling us what to do. They're telling us, you know, practice mindfulness, do yoga, make friends. You know, do these things and you're going to be healthy. But what I think that I appreciate, especially for first responders, because we're all so stubborn, is here is a huge list of things that will put you in the parasympathetic nervous system. Find what you like and what works for you and do it. And I found that that approach allows people to start where they want to start. And then when you start to see like, hey, this works, I feel better. I'm healthier. I'm happier, like I'm less burned out. I like going to work. Then, hey, let's try this one. Maybe I will try mindfulness. But you know, when we tell first responders the first thing is mindfulness or yoga, they normally turn it off and they're like, nah, not doing that. But then when you talk about other things like, hey, do you have a hobby that you enjoy? Mm-hmm. Did you know that fishing is an awesome form of mindfulness, or playing catch, you know, is a way of play? And then when people start to see those little things, it explodes.
If you can embrace the concept and the idea of gratitude, so many things will begin to unfold in front of you. So many doors will open, so many windows open, the sun will shine in. Gratitude is really the go-to for so many different things. And it's free, right? Like we don't have to have a physical thing in our presence to be able to use that as a positive intervention. You just have to open your heart and your mind. And if you can share that gratitude with others, you'll be benefiting yourself, but at the same time, benefiting others in the process, right? Mm-hmm. And then the biggest piece of gratitude, which is probably the hardest, is to allow people to show gratitude towards you. Mm-hmm. And if you can just embrace that, open your heart and let it in. But what's so important is to remember, they are feeling good about themselves if you let that gratitude in.
I love studying heart rate variability. That's definitely a big piece of where I'm at. And I know this episode, the conversation is organizational leadership and mental mm-hmm. health. And so that actually ties in, because in looking at heart rate variability and what we just talked about, when you work in an environment where you don't feel safe to speak up, you feel like any mistake, you're going to have your head chopped off. You feel like your supervisor is looking for a reason to write you up or, you know, punish you or take you off a list, then your body is in that sympathetic nervous system. Mm-hmm. You're in fight or flight, very slow drips of the cortisol just is released throughout the day, and your heart rate variability is plummeted. So we know that when you work in an environment where you can openly admit mistakes, you can say, hey, I need help. I don't understand this. When you know that your leader has your back and that there's trust there, your heart rate variability is increased. So That's actually the focus. I'm in the final class of EFO, and the focus of my capstone is organizational leadership. And I'm trying right now, I'm working on the literature review, trying to tie in mental health of first responders to leadership, and then to create a study to that can hopefully, you know, demonstrate the value of very little leader, like very simple leadership practices. And that's why before we started, I asked about the book, The Culture Code, if you had read, read it.
Yeah.
And that book is kind of the backbone of the work I'm doing, because what was fascinating about that book is they studied several high performing organizations, everything from the Navy SEALs to Disney, Pixar, to even Gramercy Tavern in New York. They found all these organizations that were high performance and had happy employees. And they looked, you know, what are the things that led to this? And what they found was it was very simple leadership practices that signaled like two messages. The leader signaled a little bit of vulnerability and then delivered what they call belonging cues. So cues that let the other person know that they belong and that, you know, they're part of this team and mistakes are okay. But what was neat, the book also talked about, it wasn't all about like happy, fuzzy, friendly, you know, make all the mistakes you want. We're not going to be perfect. There was also this underlying theme of excellence, you know, and they had, you know, one line, it was 18 magical words of the perfect feedback. And it basically was, you know, I'm giving you this feedback because I believe in you. We have high expectations and I know that you can achieve our expectations. So you're letting them know about the high expectations, but you're also letting them know, hey, I believe in you and you're a part of this awesome team. And so that book just really fascinating to me. And so that's where I'm trying to just tie that in to the first responder world and maybe hopefully use and learn about some of those small cues. Like, for example, another one is, you know, not just profuse eye contact and active listening, but also a lot, like an overabundance of small courtesies, like thank yous. And it even spent a chapter on why saying thank you is important and why when somebody is thanked for doing something, it actually will encourage them to give more later. And it like all that was just so fascinating to me. So just understanding how those small things deliver belonging cues, which make people feel safe, which help them to relax, increase their heart rate variability, and make them more resilient. So now a team can go out and be exposed to something horrible and horrendous, but they have a much greater chance of recovering and moving forward without feeling damaged. Did I lose y'all?
No, no, it was it's just a question of what do we unpack first. But Ram, why don't you run with it?
Well, first of all, congratulations on getting to the point of your capstone of EFO. That's fantastic and obviously a super important subject. So I'm glad I look forward to seeing the research, seeing what comes out.
Awesome. Thank you. It's also at the point in my EFO journey where I'm like, do I quit now? I don't know if I can do this.
The other thing that based on that and based on a good number of the, you know, your obvious deep knowledge of the background on anti-fragility and all the other things that you were talking about, it makes me think as a company officer in the department that I'm in, I'm lucky enough to be in a place where the chief is very supportive of positive mental health. The town, the ultimate employer, also is. They're very supportive. There's a lot of resources available. And I was aware of that as a company officer. But what I did not realize until just a happenstance conversation with my crew is how few of our firefighters and paramedics, boots on the ground, were aware that all of these resources were available to them. Sometimes a problem would come up that I would deal with as a company officer, and I would address that, make sure that individual got those resources. But of course, inherent to that is the privacy of not, you know, announcing, hey, you know, look at all this great stuff that we gave, you know, Ted, because Ted was having a real crisis and blah, blah, blah. So with your deep background knowledge in this and obviously your passion for it and the support resources, how do you make sure that your boots on the ground crews know that they have access to this, or how do you encourage them to use this? You know, where does the rubber meet the road for you and your organization?
No, and that's definitely the challenge, because as we know, especially for young people, until it matters, it doesn't matter. And we throw a lot of information, a lot of resources, a lot of things at our young firefighters and other first responders. And, you know, it's almost like they're drinking out of the fire hose, right? Mm-hmm. And so if they're not thinking of mental health, if, you know, if we're trying to teach people in the academy about, you know, the divorce and this and that, at that point, they're like, nah, not, it doesn't affect me. So it definitely does gloss over. What I found and what the research says is the best thing that we can do and the best thing our leaders can do is model like resource utilization, and then also share your stories. It's, I think, where we are now, and what scares me is so many departments are really embracing mental health, really embracing peer support, CISM, clinicians, EAP. However, they're doing it in a very sterilized manner. Hey guys, it's okay not to be okay. If you struggle with alcohol, depression, anxiety, here are the resources, use them. And our company officers, when they get promoted and they do the, you know, the interpersonal problem or whatever, there's always an opportunity to refer somebody to EAP. And you have to make that referral to get that extra point. So our company officers, in the back of their head, even before they promote, it's, if somebody's struggling, refer. And they're thinking refer, refer, refer. Well, we all know, if my company officer or my leader says, hey, Dina, you should go see EAP, I'm going to have all of my defenses are going to turn on and be like, oh no, I want to keep my job. I'm okay. There's nothing wrong with me, and I'm going to be afraid. So those resources are definitely all important and we need them, but I think messaging is more important, and having our leaders share their struggles, share their resource utilization. I heard a story of a fire chief who on his calendar every other Thursday at 2 o'clock, it said therapy appointment. And everybody knew every other Thursday he was going to his therapist. I mean, what kind of message is that for people? Like, man, if the chief can see a therapist, it's okay. But also just for leaders to be able to share, hey, when I was a few years on a job, I went on this call and I had a hard time with it, and this is how I got through it. Or, you know, when I went through my divorce, it was the worst experience of my life. I thought about suicide. I had all these negative thoughts and I didn't think I'd get through it. But after seeing a marriage counselor and talking to somebody else who went through it, it really got me through. And those messages and those stories, what they do is they give people hope. Mm-hmm. And even if people, when they hear stuff or when they hear these stories, it doesn't affect them, they remember a lot of times stories from others. They remember the leaders that struggled and moved through struggle. And when they find themselves in a similar situation, I think they're going to be more likely to reach out to those leaders or to ask those questions. And that's why, you know, we talked about Daniel Cole's book, and the other piece of it was vulnerability from leaders. That's why leadership vulnerability is so important. I think a lot of us, and we got, I believe we're moving into a better direction now, but I would say what I saw 5 years ago, as opposed to even now, was a lot of our leaders felt the need to portray perfection. Mm. That I am the leader. I will answer all questions. I will set that positive example. You'll never see me make a mistake or have any vulnerability. And today we know that that's not really helpful leadership, because none of us are perfect. We're all going to screw up. And if our leader can't, you know, demonstrate that, then how would we ever feel safe doing it? So personally, I believe the best way to make sure people know about these resources is to share stories. And it can be small 2-3 minute videos. Or annually, I think it's important annually during training at some point, at least have an hour where we talk about something mental health related, have a clinician come in, share a new resource, and then tie to that 5 to 10 minute story from one of our members. And how powerful would that be? And what's cool is, at least what I've seen, is when people get through to the other side and they're in a good place, a lot of times they're happy to share their story because they know that it can help others. Now, on the other side, the danger pieces I've seen also, before people have gone down the healing journey, the first step is they want to shout to everybody, like, hey, I have PTSD and I'm fighting it, I'm okay. And that's not the time to share the story. We want to share the story once people have, you know, found their path to healing, because the whole piece of building hope is seeing that path through to healing.
When it comes to occupational cancer exposures, members of the fire service are some of the highest risk professionals nationwide. Firefighters Against Cancer and Exposures, also known as the FACES Foundation, is an advocacy organization established to bring awareness, resources, and peer support to responders in need of additional help in battling potential cancer diagnoses or critical concerns. The FACES Foundation was established by a national alliance of first responders to offer supplemental resources for firefighters. One of its core initiatives is cancer awareness in the form of prevention and early detection, supporting vigilance about occupational cancers and cancer recurrence through our national Get Checked Now campaign. Also, the FACES Foundation publishes a major public catalog of resources for the many areas of need, including information on clinical and mental health therapies, benefits and compensations, funding sources and financial strategies. For more information, please visit the FACES website at facesusa.org.
Connected with everything you just mentioned, this podcast really was born because the local organization that that does CISD, CISM, EMDR therapy came around to the fire department and did a presentation, and they do it with a first responder telling their story. And that opened my eyes, and that really led to the inception of this podcast because of that, you know, meeting these clinicians and seeing what they did. So, you know, I think you're totally on point with that. I just wanted to approach it from a different angle as a leader, as an officer. If you have someone, one of your members who's struggling, how do you approach having a conversation with them to kind of bring it to light or help them, you know, find the appropriate resources?
Awesome question. Very important question. So, and this is not something that we do and have never done, but number one, I think every leader who wants to help other people should go sit in Al-Anon, go sit in an Al-Anon meeting and kind of understand how that process is. So AA is Alcoholic Anonymous, and people struggling with addiction go to AA to find support and community. Al-Anon is actually very similar, but it's for family members of those struggling. And the biggest thing the family members learn is you can't force anybody to do anything. You can't fix anybody. All you can do is support them and maybe know some resources when they're ready for the resources to share. And the reason I say I wish all of our leaders would go to that is because a lot of leaders want to learn how to help people, but then they want to be fixers and they want to force people to be helped. And what we know is until somebody's ready for help, until they're ready for the next step, we can't force anybody to do anything. So the best thing leaders can do is be patient and be caring. And so one of the biggest things I've learned and I try to share is when you see somebody struggling, it's not about saying, hey, David, man, you're struggling. You're screwed up. Go get help. Here's the resources. Call them. I'm going to follow up. Let me know how they went. It's more like, hey, David, I've noticed this and I'm worried about you. Do you want to talk? It's building that relationship, showing that you care and showing that you want to be there with them. The best thing leaders can do is not refer, but actually collaborate. If you truly want to be a good leader, if you actually care about your people, if you truly want that responsibility, it's about developing those relationships and being their partner in this. So the first step is, I've seen this, I've noticed this, or you made this comment. I'm scared. I'm worried. You know, I hate to hear you're going through this. How can I help you? What do you need? Find out from them what they need and then share the resources. And I think when you build that relationship and you show that you care, they're just going to be so much more likely to receive those resources. But also something else I learned is in my own personal experience, right? I know all the answers. I've been studying this. So like, if you're struggling, ask for help, go see a clinician. Well, I still struggle. And the first step to Dina struggling is shut down. Don't talk to anybody, isolate, be angry, be alone, act out a little bit. And I just know that. And even in those moments, I'm like, gosh, I know better than this. Like, this is not the right way to handle stress, but it's the way I handle stress. I need to get to the right moment before I speak to somebody, before I reach out, before I communicate. And I also have learned that sometimes I need the right moment before I call my clinician. I just need a little bit of time. So with that, I know that you can't force people on the timeline that you think is correct. It's got to be when they're ready. If somebody's forced to do anything, it's more than likely not going to help because they're going to be resistant to it. So the best thing our leaders can do, first of all, is know the resources available and use them. Even if you're a leader and your life is perfect, which I haven't met very many, and you're living the most perfect life, just make an appointment with a therapist to see what that's all about. I found that 95% of people I've spoken to that made an appointment with a therapist, whether they were in crisis or just wanted to, you know, unburden themselves a little bit, they all came back and they were like, wow, that was super helpful. That really helped me to understand some blind spots in my life that I didn't even realize. So use resources just so you know what you're referring people to.
Great idea.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic message too. I love hearing that, you know, everybody's got their individual ins to be able to access resources in sort of the right way, the right time. And I think that's a really important message for leaders of all levels, but especially company officers who are sort of working with people day to day, that it can't just be a reaction of, well, that's it. I got to grab them, drag them into the office. And, you know, I'm going to hit you with resources until you get better. That, you know, it's got to be more of that personal approach. And it comes down to one of the things that we always say over and over again about leadership, right? Is you got to know your people. And if you think maybe you don't know your people as well as you probably should, then it's time to get to know your people better. And it doesn't mean that we're always going to be buddies. It isn't necessarily that, but you have to know enough about them so that you can lead them in the way that they need to be led, like you're talking about.
Absolutely. And what's so cool and my favorite part of all of this and everything I've learned is relationships matter and relationships make a big deal. So even if you don't truly know enough about mental health as a leader and you don't even know all the resources or all the steps somebody needs to take, if you truly show people that you care about them and you're there for them, you have a much greater chance of helping people through really difficult times. And I always have to try to remind people of that. Like, you, when somebody comes to you and says, hey, I'm struggling, when they admit that to you, wow, what a gift. Because it's really hard for us to admit that we're struggling. So for us to feel that we trust somebody enough to let them know that we're struggling, that means that person has already done something right. Mm-hmm. And that's a gift. And you don't have to have answers. You don't have to be able to fix. Really just showing that person that you care and that you're willing to listen and not judging them and letting them know like, hey, I'm here for you. Wow, that's really hard. I'm so glad you told me. Just things like that make a huge difference. But of course, then adding your knowledge of the next steps for people. But sometimes, and it's beautiful, sometimes people don't even need those next steps if they have appropriate immediate support and consistent support around them.
Right. The trust is the key word, I think, in all of that, right? Building it and maintaining it, and then it will pay benefits in terms of that ability of people to feel comfortable enough to come to you, come to you as their officer, as their leader, to discuss something that is quite, you know, some people quite private, and rightly so. So thank you for shedding the light on that. And there are so many topics I would love to cover with you, and maybe this is one episode not going to be enough, but Ram, is there some other questions or thoughts you wanted to bring up at this point?
Nothing without opening up so many different cans and going down so many different pathways. I've taken some notes on some of the books that you talked about. I've got to do my homework. When we're done, I got to start doing my homework.
We do have a few more minutes, and one of the things that I would love you to dive into a little deeper, Chief, is sleep, because aside from the PTS ramifications of of non-quality sleep, I know there are also immune system consequences, even leading into cancer diagnoses and that kind of thing. Can you dive a little deeper into sleep and all that you've learned in terms of, you know, overall firefighter wellness and the ability to kind of be at our best doing the job? How can we kind of do better sleep hygiene on the job?
We have 5 hours now. No, sleep is definitely been for me one of the most eye-opening areas of knowledge and one of the areas that I have completely revamped my life to incorporate more of, just upon learning and finding more out about sleep and the value of sleep and what it does for us. So you hit on cancer. And so now we definitely recognize the causal link, meaning you sleep less. There is a link between less sleep and cancer. It's absolutely there. Dr. Walker shared that just one night of insufficient sleep will render 70% of our cancer fighting cells ineffective. Mm-hmm. And then when you live a life like first responders, where it's consistent nights of insufficient sleep, your body actually goes into that chronic inflammation state. And we hear chronic inflammation a lot, and a lot of us don't really understand what that is, but that's where your body is in fight or flight most of the time. And again, we know what that does to heart rate variability. But also what the researchers found was your bodies have cancer fighting cells and they're all over. And when you sleep well, you have a lot of them. And so all day, every day, it doesn't matter how clean an environment you're in, you're going to be exposed to cancer. Cancer is everywhere and everything. There's no way to completely avoid cancer, unfortunately. But when your T cells are strong and abundant, they're going to kill the cancer. They're going to continue to attack the cancer. However, when we end up in that chronic inflammation state where it's consistent poor sleep, your T cells are actually replaced with these metastasizing cells. And in fact, they did a study in Chicago of two groups of mice, and they implanted both groups of mice with tumors. And one group was able to sleep all night undisturbed. The other group got disturbed all night long. And after a few weeks, the group with the disturbed sleep, the tumor grew by 200%. The group that did not have disturbed sleep, the group that slept well, the tumor didn't grow at all. Mm-hmm. So it just showed that relationship there and the value of sleep. So again, we talked earlier about how us as first responders, we are going to have more stressors than other people. Mm-hmm. We're going to have more exposure to carcinogens. So I know all the campaigns now, and I'm excited that you got to talk to Chief Lieb because he does so much great work with cancer and cancer prevention. And a lot of the discussion on cancer prevention is all about clean cabs, clean gear, clean body. But equally important is sleep, mm-hmm. because you want that strong immune system. And they even found with vaccinations like the flu vaccine, or even the COVID vaccine, which I know is controversial, but any vaccine, if you have had good sleep leading up to that vaccine for over a week, more than likely that vaccine is going to do what it's supposed to do. If you've had poor sleep, the vaccine is going to be very ineffective because your immune system is not going to be able to receive it appropriately. So that's a little bit on sleep with the immune system. Something else that we know, besides just what I talked about earlier on PTSD, sleep does a lot for our memory. And one of the coolest things Dr. Walker says is, you know, it's not just practice until you get it perfect, or practice makes perfect. It's practice plus sleep that makes perfect. And he showed all this evidence for how basically what he says is sleep hits the save button on memories. Mm-hmm. Without sleep, the save button doesn't get hit. And so a lot of times, especially for us studying for promotional exams and whatnot, what we give up is sleep so that we can study more. But it was fascinating to learn that you'll actually retain it better with sleep. But then, and this one right here has hit me hard because my mom has dementia, and she's in that early stages of dementia where the behavior is changing and it's pretty scary. And something else that we learned is insufficient sleep also leads to Alzheimer proteins being deposited in the brain. And the only way of flushing these is actually quality and quantity of sleep. So full night of sleep. So with that, you asked about sleep hygiene, which I think is important. I could scare people all day long about what happens when you don't sleep. And I hope people take it to heart. We talked earlier, when you don't get the REM sleep, you're going to be more likely to have PTSD. REM sleep, and I saw a couple of the hosts are EMDR therapists. Mm-hmm. REM sleep is almost the equivalent of EMDR. So when we think about, you know, going to or having that EMDR therapy and how it helps, if you're getting sleep, you may prevent the chances of needing EMDR therapy, because sleep is, both Dr. Bessel van der Kolk and Dr. Walker say, is inbuilt therapy. That's what it's doing. It's helping you process those memories and pull away that trauma. But with the hygiene, big things, and I did ask Dr. Walker, we talked about schedules. And basically what he said, the best schedule for first responders is the one that has the least number of transitions. Because the best thing we can do sleep hygiene-wise is routine. Mm-hmm. If you go to bed every night at 10, your body starts to recognize that and you'll fall asleep better. But if it's always changing, it's hard to get that routine. So it's hard for your body to recognize when it's time to sleep. Something too that I learned about building that routine is the minute you wake up, if you can get about 10 minutes of sunlight, that actually signals to your circadian rhythm that this is the start of the day. And in 18 hours, it'll be time to sleep. So going outside and actually seeing the sun is important. Spending time in the sun is important. And there have been, I've been at conferences. I did it recently and I realized it 3 days later. I was at this conference and I never left the hotel. And I was like, holy crap. And I realized like, I need to go get a little bit of sun. But routine's so important. And we know for firefighters, the best schedule is 24/72. So 1 day on, 3 days off, that's a 43-hour work week. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, a lot of the fire service is still in the 56-hour work week. And so with that, the best options are not optimal. None of them are. And you see a lot of fighting over 48/96 mm-hmm. And others. And the one positive to the 48/96, well, there's a few positives, but the one positive in terms of sleep is that is the one that has the most recovery built in and the least transitions, meaning the more opportunity to develop that routine. So routine's so important. Making your room or your cube. And I found this, I always wondered why at work I would fall asleep quicker than at home. And I realized my cube at the fire station literally was just a bed. I didn't do anything in there. I didn't study. I didn't watch TV. I went to bed. So my body saw that that was sleep. At home, I used to watch Netflix. I used to read. I used to do work. My room, you know, was an area to do lots of things. And so my body didn't recognize it. So that was another big piece of advice from Dr. Walker is make your sleeping area for two things, sleep and sex. Apparently sex will not interrupt your routines there. So, but don't do that at work.
Good to know.
Don't advocate that at work.
Pro tip.
Yeah. Pro tip. Don't do that at work. So at home, I've actually changed the routine here to where I have my Kindle. So I still read, and reading actually helps me go to sleep. Or even sometimes when you wake up at 3 a.m. and can't fall asleep, I found if I open up the Kindle for about 15 minutes, it helps me sleep. So my room literally is, you know, when I go to bed, it's just to go to sleep. Like it's not to watch TV or to do work or even reading something for work. The reading that I do in bed is just enjoyment. It's relaxation. It's to help me fall asleep. So that that routine's big, and we can build that into our firehouses. So there's naps that can be super important. Mm-hmm. And there's always been controversy over napping and laziness and this and that. But what we know is there's two types of naps that you could take or use to your benefit. So take, for example, you didn't sleep well last night and you're just not like fully alert, that's where that short nap can actually be really beneficial, that 15 to 20 minute nap. And Dr. Allison Brager, she calls it a tactical nap. And one of her recommendations is drink a little caffeine right before you do it. And then take that 15 to 30 minute nap. And then right when you wake up, the caffeine kicks in. I found too that if I drink like a whole cup of coffee or like a bigger cup of coffee, I'll have to wake up to go pee. So it keeps me from oversleeping. And that's a tactic that I've had to put in because I can resist waking up. So I'll purposely drink more. I'll drink like a big cup of water too, just to make sure that like I have to get up. And I found that works. And so that's good for if you need energy to make it through the day. If you're on a busy company and you're going to be up all night, if you are expected to run a lot of calls, the recommendation is actually get a full 90-minute nap late in the afternoon, early evening. And what that does is that gets you one full cycle of sleep because throughout the night we have five cycles and we need all five cycles. And they say that if you can get at least one full cycle of sleep before a busy night, it will help you during the night to be more alert and to make better decisions and whatnot. So another piece of advice that I recently learned that I thought was actually super helpful. So we know during the day, we talked about like 18 hours from the minute you wake up to the minute you're sleepy. Mm-hmm. And in those 18 hours, adenosine is that chemical that builds throughout the day. And that chemical is that sleep chemical that makes you sleepy 18 hours later. And so what caffeine does is it blocks it. So that's why caffeine can be helpful. But then the minute caffeine wears off, it has still been building in the background. So it's it's at that high level. Well, I didn't understand this, but if you don't sleep a full 8 hours, you don't have an opportunity to release it all. Because while you sleep, that adenosine is released. So say, for example, you only slept 6 hours. You wake up, you feel a little groggy. Our instinct is to drink caffeine if we didn't sleep good, to drink caffeine right away.
Right.
So I was I actually got this listening to an episode with Jocko, and I'm drawing a brain fart, but he is a neuroscientist that Jocko was talking to who studies sleep. And what he said was, actually, if when you first wake up, if you don't drink caffeine, and if you actually work out, but even if you don't work out, that's okay. If you work out, it works quicker. But if you don't drink caffeine, if you wait about an hour and a half before your first cup of coffee, you can actually eliminate it more naturally. Mm-hmm. If you drink caffeine, you won't eliminate that adenosine. So that was a good piece of advice. So I've started trying to wait about an hour and a half before I have that first cup of coffee if I didn't get a good night's sleep.
Wow. So work out first and then drink the coffee.
Well, and that's actually what I do at work. I get in and it's not like intense, but I go to the gym 30 minutes and just lift. Mm-hmm. And so I'll actually make a cup of coffee. I'll drink a little bit on the way in just out of habit, but I usually only drink maybe like that much of my cup, get to the firehouse, knock out a 30-minute workout, and then I get to drink all of the coffee.
That's your reward.
Yeah, good habits. It is. And this has actually worked. And it was funny because I was actually doing that before I learned that it was actually helpful. I was actually at a boss, and it was funny because I got mad at him because I used to get to work, we do staffing, and then I'd go work out. But he kind of was like, hey, I want all the chief officers in their uniform by 7:30. So I'd rather you work out before. And I really didn't like that because I was like, oh, I'm going to lose sleep. But it was funny, after I listened to that episode, I had to call him and I was like, hey, you actually, without knowing it, helped me to like build better habits. So thank you. I appreciate you. I'm sorry I gave you a hard time.
That's fantastic. Well, very quickly, I just wanted to mention, if anybody's interested in learning more about sleep, besides all the amazing information you just shared with us, Chief, Matthew Walker has got a book called Why We Sleep. He's got his own podcast. He had a couple of amazing interviews on the Tim Ferriss Show. Highly recommend all of those. And Ram, any kind of closing thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I just want to say thank you, Chief. That's a lot of good information and a lot of good tips to help make the information practical and how we can use it for ourselves and the people that we want to lead and the leaders we want to become. That so often it can be difficult to, you know, sort of choke down this information and absorb all of, you know, the importance of sleep and its relation to cancer and all of that kind of stuff and go like, oh, okay. And it can be difficult to sort out, especially as we're going through our day to day and living life, what we're supposed to do with that. And I think you've really helped. I know you've helped me. Hopefully you've helped a lot of other people watching the show.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you. This was really fun. And you guys had the perfect questions. I'm glad we didn't like prepare them ahead of time. This worked great. Very well. Yeah,
fantastic. So Chief, before we go, how can people find you out there? What's the best way to follow you or get in touch?
Well, the way you guys reached out, LinkedIn is usually the best way, especially that's where I share anything that I write or anything that I'm working on. LinkedIn's best way. Facebook's more like family and friends and nothing very productive. But I am on Facebook and Instagram, but LinkedIn is where I try to keep all of the professional and the work and the research.
Remember to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, all the podcast platforms, and check out our website, respondertv.com, for all our past episodes and guest information. Captain Ram Duckworth, thank you for being our guest co-host today. And Chief Dean Ali, thank you again for being with us.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.